Good morning. Thank you all for coming. Sorry for being a little tardy this morning. It is Tuesday, the 8th of March at 10:06, and House Fisheries will now come to order. Members present are Representative Ortiz, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Chair Stutes. We have no quorum just as of yet, but hopefully we will before the meeting's over. We're joined by Kelly Burnett from House Records, Matt Kern from the LIO, and of course, Trustee Reed Harris, my committee aide. Today we're going to address House Bill 251, electronic tax returns and fishery taxes. Are there any questions from the committee before we start public testimony? Okay. I will now open public testimony for Fisheries House Bill 251. Is there anyone here? Let me look. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 251? Nope. Okay, then we will first go to the Wrangell LIO. Oh, we have Leslie Rice from Fish and Game. You're just there for informational purposes, Leslie? Are you there? Guess not. Okay, then we will go to, let's see here, I'm going to look at the time. To Kenai, Paul Dale.
Yeah, hello, Madam Chairwoman and members of the House Fisheries Committee. My name is Paul Dale. My wife and I operate Snug Harbor Seafoods in Kenai, have for 25 years. We buy salmon at Cook Inlet, Prince William Sound, halibut, and sable fish. And recently gotten a little involved in a crab. The Dutch Harbor area. My personal belief on taxes is they are the price I pay for leading a civilized life, and I always hope I can meet that obligation, and I consider it an obligation. Fisheries, as I think all of us that are involved know, have paid our way in Alaska, will continue to pay our way in Alaska as an industry. But I think at this time we're being asked to do a bit more, what we can do, what we think we can handle to help solve Alaska's finances in a longer term. I personally find the general range of revenue increases recommended by the governor to be palatable to me as to where and how. I know that a proposal has been made available to you from the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, Ocean Beauty, and Icicle. I had not seen this until this morning, but it recommends, I think, what might be termed a 4-4-4-4 proposal, evening out the various business taxes between shore-based and floaters, a 4% resource landing tax, reducing the canned salmon tax 0.5%, and reducing the floating processing tax 1%. I would concur with that, except one point, and that is I think we should retain the 2% differential between shore-based processing companies and floating processing. And I think so because the long-standing view, I believe, is that the benefits that accrue to Alaskan communities is far greater with shore-based facilities than floating facilities. And I believe that to be true, and I think it's important to encourage shore-based processing whenever and wherever is possible. I support the specific comments from Rhonda Hubbard regarding streamlining information between Department of Fish and Game and Department of revenue. I think that's completely logical. I support the comments you've received from the Drift Association in Cook Inlet regarding the need to decrease foregone harvest that we're actually have seen increase the last half dozen years. It just seems sensible to harvest what we can when we can and pay taxes on it and get those, get that money running through the communities. And I certainly support the PSPA observations on closing various loopholes that will accrue increased value to the state from fisheries. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. Are there any questions from this committee? Thank you. Oh, did you have one?
Brief at ease.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Dale. Fred Sturman?
My name is Fred Sturman. I've been fishing in Cook Inlet now for 45 years, and I am still definitely at the same thing that I've testified at nearly all of these different hearings and stuff. I'm against this bill completely, 100%. The reason I'm against it is you haven't cut 30%. In 2000, we had 14,000 employees. Today, we got over 17,000 employees. I'm looking up at some of the employees' salaries at $300,000 plus benefits, a lot of them at $200,000, and the governor's only making $145,000 plus benefits. Whenever you guys cut 30% out of this budget, 30% of the labor, then I will be more than glad to give you some more of my money. But I don't, with what the governor just done, you guys should be ashamed of even considering anything until you cut this government. When the governor says there'll be no layoffs and they're going to give $9 million back over 3 years, but they're still going to get their increases when everybody else is taking a decrease. I can give you some examples here real quick. One of the oil companies here, or service companies here, just laid off the top boss, the top salesperson, and everything else, and they got it down to the third guy on the list. Now, he's the boss, he's the salesman, and plus, you know what? He had to take a 10 to 15% cut in salary to keep his job. On the slope, they just laid off another 200 people today. They've laid off over 1,500 at Anchorage, and they're laying them off here left and right, and I haven't seen one government employee lose his job or any of his salaries. They still get their health insurance increase this year and all the other stuff to go along with this. I am really disappointed in your committee to even consider raising any taxes from fishing when you have done no cutting at all. So this is the way I feel about it. And whenever you do come back with this next bill, when we go maybe give you some money when you cut it, how about adding something to some of the sports fisheries here and the fisheries here? And if you got any questions, my phone number is 252-0100. Feel free to call me and I'll give you some more examples. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sturman, and thank you for your testimony. And I would like to take this opportunity to welcome Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions from this committee for Mr. Sturman? Okay. I might mention, sitting here, we have the Director of Finance, Jerry Burnett. We also have Ken Alper, and we have Kevin Brooks, the Deputy Commissioner of Department of Fish and Game. So if there's any questions, we have them available. And we also have Representative Herron. We do have a quorum. Thank you. Okay, we will now go to the Anchorage LIO, and we have Arnie Thompson. And excuse me, just one moment. We have Representative Millett here as well. Thank you, Representative Millett. Mr. Thompson, are you there?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Yes, I'm here.
Good morning. Please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Arnie Thompson. I'm a consultant for Alaska Salmon Alliance, and we represent seafood processors and commercial fishermen based on the Kenai Peninsula and in the Anchorage and Matsu area. ASA is pleased with your open and comprehensive approach to new revenues being proposed for not only fisheries but other resource taxes. ASA is also pleased that you have temporarily put HB 251 on hold until you are comfortable that the fishing industry is not being singled out from other industries. ASA also agrees with the comments of other fishing representatives that the tax plan is oversimplified, rushed, and ignores other resource taxes in the state. The fisheries tax schedule is one of the more complex in the Alaska Code. I'm reading here from a letter for record that ASA submitted to your committee, Madam Chair, and so I won't go any further with the letter because I wanted to just add a few comments. And first of all, I wish to make reference to the United Fishermen of Alaska seafood industry taxes and fees, which shows that despite some criticism to the contrary, that the seafood industry contributes revenues far in excess of the costs of state and local government for managing and for research in the fisheries. And just to be clear, as UFA notes in their fact sheet, the seafood taxes and fees total paid to the state and communities is $121 million in 2014. This exceeds the $96.8 million in terms of research and management costs that the state undergoes in terms of management of fisheries. I'd also like to note that the seafood industry that operates in the federal waters also pays a lot of fees, and they bring fish ashore, they pay taxes in the state, but the federal sector included, you have a total of $250 million per year in taxes and fees that are paid out. I would also like to reference Paul Dale's comments about the Cook Inlet drifters' concerns about foregone harvest and the costs that is bringing on not only the industry but the state in terms of lost revenues to the state. And so if foregone harvest concerns could be addressed in Cook Inlet and other areas in the state, I think we could find a significant increase in revenues. The PSPA letter also expresses concerns similar to the ASA concerns that additional taxes assessed now will only serve to reduce Alaskan jobs. In the year 2015, the Alaska Salmon Alliance contracted with the McDowell Group to do an economic impact analysis of the seafood industry in South Central Alaska. This report analysis was completed in June of 2015. ASA appreciates that you, Madam Chair, gave us the opportunity to present a summary in your committee of that analysis. And I just want to reference briefly in the main report one section which goes into detail about the seafood industry support sector, particularly in the Anchorage and Matsu area, and it identifies 84 public agencies, support businesses, organizations, and facilities in the Anchorage Matsu area that are involved in the support sector and are a significant part of a $1.2 billion industry in South Central Alaska.
Mr. Thompson, I'm going to have to ask you if you could sum it up, please.
Yes, I will. The $1.2 billion industry, about 40% of that total is revenue that is picked up by the support sector and the industry. And thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. And I would like to welcome Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
Are there any questions here for Mr. Thompson? Okay. Seeing none, we will go to Seward and Rhonda Hubbard. If you would state your name and identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, hello, this is Rhonda Hubbard from Seward. I represent Kuzaw Fisheries. We are licensed as a direct marketer as well as a floating operation from the fisheries business standpoint. And I just wanted to draw your attention to my what I had submitted for this meeting in regards to the sectional analysis and item six, or item six of that analysis, and I'm very glad to know that Mr. Brooks and Mr. Alpar are in the room, because I really believe that this is something that they can work together on, and if they could be encouraged at all or whatever it takes to leverage them into creating an integrated system for reporting, it would be much appreciated, because as I indicated and showed you through documents that I submitted, there's a horrendous amount of duplications that are going on in our reporting, and I would really like to see that mitigated. And it's just kind of the nature of the beast, because of just various rationalization plans and changes in our tax, the complexity of our fisheries taxes, that reporting has just evolved into something that's been almost unmanageable, unless we call our first mate now the paper mate, if you will. So I think you get the idea. But I'm also looking at this as being able to create a platform for a common data place, so that we can maybe address other users like the commercial guided industry to also maybe involve themselves and help pay for what they are gaining from management and enforcement and reporting as well. So they are users of the resource as well, and also need to participate in the costs that it takes to manage that resource. This is a revenue-producing industry for the state, and we got to be very careful in how we're administering taxes to the point it gets to be a kind of a diminishing returns. So, and I especially bring that up when it comes to needing adequate assessments, so that we don't lose our revenue-producing opportunities, as Paul Dale had noted. We have foregone harvest that is really causing the state to lose some money as well. So that concludes my comments, but I really would welcome any questions and about the reports that we have to do and the ease that could be brought upon us if there's an integrated system. We are in the midst of reporting, doing our core report right now, and when we fill in some of those boxes, we have to do everything by hand. We have to recalculate everything. It's just really frustrating, and it would be nice to get that streamlined. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hubbard. Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rhonda, can you speak to some of the duplication that you see, or what kind of desired integration you'd like to see in catch accounting or catch value? And specifically, if you were, you know, legislative god for a day, what kind of amendment would you put forward to fix some of the problems that you see?
Well, the amendment or mandate, as it shows there in the sectional analysis, it says there's an electronic reporting system. Well, that electronic reporting system needs to segue across the departments that are managing our fisheries. As and there was a $40 million appropriation given to the Department of Revenue to upgrade their systems. And so I'm thinking, and then we also have Fish and Game working very closely with NIMS, and they've developed this e-landing system. There's no reason why those things cannot integrate better, and we have all the data there. So, and because with all these different pieces out there, we're coming up with different information, and it's really hard to collate it all. So I don't know what a what the legalese is on making this happen, but other than just, you know, mandating that there be integration across departments that are using the same information to get results on, you know, for revenues and what have you. So I can give some specific examples, but if you start with the e-landing system, use that as a platform and have that segue into what we're re-reporting on the core report, which is also ADF&G, and what we're re-reporting on our Department of Revenue reports, I think you're going to have a much better system for not only industry, but for sure the state. So, and it gets to the point where the state folks even get confused on what they're trying to enforce or audit. And, I mean, I was a victim of that. Just, I don't know if I should go into it, but I had been, there were charges brought against me, and it cost the state a lot of money, and it had to do with the state just not even knowing what they were bringing charges against me, and so consequently 12 felony charges through a jury trial just dwindled because they didn't
excuse me.
Know what they were doing.
Let's stick to House Bill 251. Could we do that,
so that's,
please?
I'm just giving you an example of why we need the integration. So it's a kind of a long-winded answer. I'm sorry, but that concludes my testimony there.
Follow-up, Reverend Christ Hopkins?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ron, are you seeing you enter the exact same information to DOR, and then you do the exact same thing with ADF&G, and what you're wanting to see is that there's just one sort of data portal, and all the information you enter goes to all the places it needs to go?
Yeah, and at this point, the state, if it was an integrated system, they could actually be sending us a bill, which is what we're experiencing right now with NIMS fees and observer fees. So they can actually, if they really look into it, a lot of there's parts of their reports and revenue reports that they're asking that they could put the burden of proof on the industry rather than it being on them and causing them more work. I mean, the work it will be up front once we get the integrated system put together, but at the end of the day, it's going to be a lot more accurate, expedient, and accurate than they. When they pull everything together and see where they're duplicating.
Follow-up, Representative?
And Rhonda, have you reviewed Section 2 in the bill, the electronic submission of return or reports, and is there anything in that section you'd like to see change that you think would eliminate these redundancies and duplication and create an integrated system?
Is this Section 2 in the sectional analysis that you're noting?
Sectional analysis or the bill itself, either or. I guess in summary, I'm wondering what you want to have changed that would solve the problem.
It's not changed so much. It's requesting that the departments that are working with this data, because the Department of Revenue is their information to confirm if accurate or not is going to rely on ADF&G information. So it's just important that the two entities and two departments come together in getting that data pulled together so that they can that they're on the same page with it. And as you've been working on this bill, you're asking DOR for things, and then DOR says, well, I got to go to ADF&G for that. And so there's this toss between the two entities anyway. So I guess what I'm suggesting on that change, it should be documents submitted to Department of Revenue and Department of Fish and Game. That's probably where you can, if you can just include them into the sectional wording, that would probably do the trick.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ron, for testifying today. You mentioned, brought up the issue of foregone harvest and therefore potential lost revenue for the state. I've heard about this in previous testimony in relationship to House Bill 251. Can you be more specific? Is this anecdotal feeling that you have, or is there definite information or data out there that speaks about foregone harvest or lost harvest opportunities?
Well, thank you, Representative Ortiz, through the chair. I think Paul Dale can probably speak to that personally. He's over in an area right now where there is foregone harvest. And what I'm involved in is more ground fisheries, and we do have, we work with Chatham Strait and Clarence Strait, and we could see where there's certainly a need for better research there, because they keep cutting our quota, and the fishermen are going, wait a minute, this, what you're seeing, what we're seeing isn't matching up. You need to spend a little bit more time on this or whatever, because there again, why do you keep cutting our quota? You're raising the sport fishing take, yet, and then, yeah, just things aren't matching up. So we have, I think we've asked, or there might be some more funding going into that to review that a little bit more. But that is an example, and again, that's a high valued fishery that could produce more revenue for the state if we could possibly fish more. And we just feel we don't understand. There's no rhyme or reason why that quota keeps dropping over the years. But so we'd like to get a little bit more. Better assessments on that. So those are a couple of examples. But I think Paul Dale could probably speak that some in his area. I think everybody in every region in Alaska probably has a story about potential, fisheries that can be had if there was a little bit better assessment and review on them.
Thank you. Representative Heron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hubbard, I've read your written testimony. It's about the reporting requirements. And I appreciate your testimony that you provided. But my question to you is, in your conversations with Fish and Game and Department of Revenue, what is their response when you basically ask the same thing that you've provided in your written testimony? What is their response?
Yeah, Representative Heron, through the chair, thank you for the question. The response is, what I'm gathering is they're in two different worlds. They have different missions, that's fine, but they're still using the same data. And it's important, and they do have to talk to ADF, I'm talking DOR, has to talk to ADF&G to do proper auditing, to confirm if what we're telling them, what we're reporting for the third time to them, is actually true. And it's per the auditor's choice. They may or may not want to audit a particular company. I just happened to be one of those lucky ones at one time. And they did a thorough audit that went nowhere. But anyway, it's just like, and even so, they're in two rooms right now. And if I were the legislative queen, as you know, I would put those two, Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Land and Fish Tax Division, I'd put them in the same room.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is just a comment is obviously revenue and Fish and Game is here, and at the appropriate time, we could ask for what their plans are. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Yeah, thank you. And I'd echo Representative Heron, and it might be interesting to get perspective from Departments of Revenue and Fish and Game about how this perceived problem could be resolved. Just one last question, Rhonda, on the subject of developing fisheries. You've testified in the past to this and also sent a lot of written testimony. What's your perspective on the developing fisheries tax and some of the what's your perspective on the developing fisheries tax and the role it plays or how useful it is?
Yeah, Representative Tompkins, through the chair, thank you. As I sit here and try to discern through all the documents where and all the areas where fish, okay, what part of my tax return do I put developing and where do I report, that? I would just assume pay the same rate on it because it's so insignificant. And I think it probably takes the department just as much time to determine when they're going to take a fishery out of a developing state into being with the rest, the rest of the percent or the regular percentage rate. So I think either they don't have it at all or at some point just, or give it a minimum or something, but I just don't see the necessity of that. It doesn't represent a lot of money, and I don't think people, taxpayers would mind just go ahead and paying the same rate on it, so at some given whatever the value is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from this committee for Ms. Hubbard? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Hubbard.
Yes.
We will now go to Kodiak to Stephen Matthew. Scrim, hello. You there?
Yeah, hello. Good morning. Say, I'm not really that familiar.
State your name and your affiliation for the record, please.
Oh, my name is Steve Matthew. I'm a state resident and fisherman in Alaska for the last 40-some years. And I didn't see anywhere on this bill indicating, I'm sorry, I just got a copy of this bill, so I'm not up to speed quite yet, if that's a term people are familiar with. But I don't see any reason why an increase is needed. It doesn't say exactly what what this money is going to be used for. It just goes into some kind of general fund. I mean, I think if the general fund is lacking any kind of money, maybe we ought to put that increase back on the oil companies that the governor took away. Anyhow, I'm wondering, some of my questions regarding this bill are, what is the minimum value that the state puts on each species of fish? You know, I mean, I'd like to know that. And I'm wondering, what percentage of fish tax do the CDQ holders pay? Like, the communities all hold some quota. What percentage do those communities pay to the state? Or is it just the fishermen that pays the fish taxes? You know? I'm wondering, do the processors pay an equal amount of fish taxes the fishermen do, or do they just collect the fish tax from the fishermen? And I'm wondering, will any of this fish tax money be specifically earmarked to help the fishermen in any way? I mean, to set up fishermen infrastructure so fishermen can start moving their own fish out of the state, which we've never had any kind of structure like that provided for us by our fish taxes. I'd just like to say, other than that, just good morning to Fred Sternum over there in Sturman over there in Kenai. So, that's all I was had to ask. I oppose the bill until we get some of these questions out answered in public meetings. I mean, if the fishermen are going to have to pay some kind of increase in fish tax, they should know what they're going to get for it, because what they've been getting so far isn't helping increase the price of fish at all to them. So, I mean, everywhere else in the free world, codfish averages about $2 a pound, $2.50 a pound. Pollock is $1.50 a pound on the free market. Why don't we see those prices here in Alaska? It's because fishermen have no infrastructure provided to them by the state through their fish taxes to move their fish out to the market. So I think we need some more public hearings on this fish tax increase before it gets approved. Thank you. That's all I have to say today, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Matthew. Are there any questions? Seeing none. Okay. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? And I see no one else online, so I'm going to close public testimony. And maybe now would be a good time to have the Department of Revenue and the Department of Fish and Game come up and see if they can address some of the
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for Fish and Game. To be honest, this is the first I've heard from Rhonda's comments about the disconnect between the departments, and I guess my pledge to the committee and to the folks listening would be to work with Mr. Elper and Mr. Burnett, figure out how we can have a more seamless transition between the two departments that's easier for fishermen to interact with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. I concur with Deputy Commissioner Brooks. I think Ms. Hubbard is on the right track. We should be coordinating our paperwork. There is no rational reason to have to fill out the same form in duplicate for two different agencies. I don't know the degree to which our new software system, which is rolled out and now functional for the fish tax as of a few weeks ago, can export data to them. I mean, they have their own data requirements from the fish tickets. This is a project for the interim. I kind of look forward to it. Our team, their team at the staff level and at the leadership level are going to try to resolve this, and hopefully we'll come back in January and tell you what we've done. I don't know that we can do anything meaningful and material within the context of this bill. This is a tax bill, but you have both of our pledges to work together and try to solve this.
Thank you. I think that's a wonderful idea. It always works a little bit better if you can streamline government just that much more. Are there any questions? Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken and Kevin, would you be able to walk us through the process that, and Rhonda is a direct processor, I guess, so if a direct processor catches a bunch of fish, wants to pay his or her fish taxes, what is the actual sort of administrative process that person would go through in terms of what information needs to go where and what kind of information?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, I'll take a first shot at this. You know, one of the things I'm going to do this summer is have somebody walk me through it. I want to see it, but I can tell you fishermen are reporting to Fish and Game on fish tickets, what they're catching, and then that has to get translated to Department of Revenue, so there's a tax event. But I'm going to start at the beginning and have someone just walk me through it, and I'd be better able to answer that question after having done that.
If I may, Madam Chair, and I might have a little bit more background on it than Deputy Commissioner Brooks, but only so much. I don't directly engage in the fish tax and how it's collected. What I would like to do, if you don't mind, is give up my chair, let Tom Sutton, who supervises the fish tax group at the Department of Revenue, sit and talk about how the process actually works in a day-to-day sort of sense.
I think that's a wonderful idea, Mr. Alper.
Thank you. My name is Tom Sutton, for the record, and I'm the Fish Tax Manager, DOR. And if I could answer your question, Mr. Chris Tompkins, through the chair, for a catcher processor, if they are fishing within Alaskan waters, which is out 3 miles, they would be filing a fish business tax return. Yeah, those who are in the federal waters out to 200 miles, from 3 to 200 miles, they'd be filing a fish landing return. And basically, the rates are for the same for the species, and whether it's developing or established on both tax returns. So there's no differential in the way of it's taxed if we're talking about the same species, whether it's caught out in federal waters versus Alaska waters. what we can use to, there is some, I guess you would say, tax returns that look maybe incorrect, and we can gather information from Fish and Game through the fish tickets to determine another opinion, I guess, or more information to see if the tax return is prepared correctly.
Representative,
if I may, so you're saying, in order to make sure that the taxes that someone is submitting are accurate, you would cross-reference ADF&G fish tickets with whatever information is being submitted to your department.
Yes.
So basically two different data sets, one from each department, and those get sort of corroborated with each other?
Right. I don't know if you would say there's two different data sets, because we have what's information from the taxpayer himself versus what's been reported to Fish and Game. And as I understand it, Fish and Game can give us information, but what's been worked out through memorandum of agreements and such is that we really don't provide any information to Fish and Game. It's all one way, from Fish and Game to DOR. Because of tax confidentiality, of course.
And
follow up.
Do you perceive any redundancy or duplication in the current system?
Well, I too just got a hold of Rhonda's memorandum on that, and I would like to look at it and have the time to see what she's pointing out, and if there is any redundancy, I certainly would want to eliminate that and get together with Fish and Game, and so that we can catch it either on our side or their side. But facilitate, the idea is to facilitate the reporting for the for taxpayers. So yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Sutton? Seeing none. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
A question for Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Brooks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Kevin, for being here today. We're obviously looking at House Bill 251 amongst a group of other potential revenue bills for the state of Alaska and, of course, to try to address our fiscal situation. You know, I don't think anybody's happy about an increase in taxes for any particular group of people. I don't think anybody, you know, certainly the governor is not joyful in his presentation of these different options. One of the questions, or one of the things that keeps coming up is there a significant foregone harvest that is out there that could very well, you know, make up some of this money that would therefore might make House Bill 251 not even necessary? I don't know if you're in a position to answer that question, and I don't know how we could ever. Is there data out there that would point to foregone harvest? It's something I think we at least need to talk about.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for Fish and Game. I think there are areas where there's foregone harvest, and I think there's a couple reasons for that. One of the biggest is if we have, for instance, one of the testifiers was from Cook Inlet. If we have a conservation concern on Chinook, and we're taking measures or through the Board of Game plans to avoid harvesting Chinook, it could result in overescaping sockeye up a river, for instance. And so there's foregone harvest due to conservation measures taken by the department on, say, another species. There's also foregone harvest that could result from, you've heard me talk about this before in other hearings, about our ability to precisely manage and allow to take full advantage of a harvestable surplus. And so as we have seen budget reductions, we become a little bit more conservative in our management. We're going to make sure that we manage for sustained yield, that we're escaping fish, but sometimes that can be at the expense of harvestable surplus.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any way to quantify or to estimate what that might be?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, in any given year on a fishery, you can certainly do that. We've had numbers, say, on Kasilof sockeye or something of that nature, but it is a tough number to get at in certain fisheries. I'm sorry, I can't be more precise than that.
Representative Johnson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. We're really talking about our inability to manage in-season salmon. We always find out if there's overescapement at the end. So the in-season management is, and it's, I understand the difficulty, I get it. It's at best a lucky guess. So we really don't know about the harvest access or the escapement goals until really the next year when we look at them. So until we can do some kind of in-season management, we're always going to have over-escapement, under-escapement. And that's just that's an issue that I don't know how we solve. Count every fish going up a river. So to me, unforgone harvest is more fish in the river, which will return better next year, which plays into an average, which allows them to guess better. So, you know, I understand the loss of economics, but it's still at best a guess, and it's always in retrospect. Thank you. And one more thing.
Representative.
And I don't want to beat up on you, but do you realize how unsatisfactory your answer was that I'm going to look into it? Don't you have a friend you could phone to tell us how this works?
Through the chair.
On the tick, on the harvest tick, on the filings?
I certainly could. I don't mean to.
Well, I don't mean
non-responsive. But it is something I think is going to take some time for us to really to get into it, because we are getting reporting on fish tickets to quantify harvest, and we use that for a very specific reason that's different from a tax reporting. But there are folks in the department that can do that. I don't have them here with me today, and I apologize for that.
I would guess that if I ask a show of hands of people in this room, they could tell you the system and how it worked.
I would agree that a taxpayer could tell you exactly how it works.
And for us as a tax collector, and I'm sorry, I have a great amount of respect for you, and I always have, but I don't mean to pick on you. You just happen to be the person there.
Understood.
But I think that's an answer that we should have been able to answer, is how at least how it's filled out. We're collecting the taxes, and we don't know.
Maybe during between now and the next fisheries meeting, we could get a brief outline of how the process works between you and the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Chairman. And I apologize. I mean, it's not.
My pledge is sincere.
I understand that. But
we'll have information back to the committee.
Your lack of understanding of the process is also sincere.
Great.
Sorry.
That's all right. Thank you. Representative Herron?
Yes, Madam Chair. If we could ask the Department of Revenue to come to the table, please, for a question to them.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Brooks.
I appreciate you stepping up to the plate. Madam Chair, in our packet of industry concerns, there is a single page from the Processors Association, Ocean Beauty, and Icicle, and their position on HB 251. I was hoping you'd had a chance to review that, because they have what they call 4444 proposal. What is the department's view of that proposal?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, thank you for thanking me for stepping up. The administration's position is to support the bill as written. To be clear, what's contained in that 4444 is a desire to equalize the tax rates across the various fisheries. So although that would be a 1% increase on all of the so-called 3% fisheries, the shore-based processors, it would also be a 1% cut on all the floating processors. That is a policy decision that you and the rest of the legislature would have to make. I don't know if there, other than the organizations in question might benefit from a 1% tax cut to the extent that they are involved in the floating industries. I don't know if there's a need in this environment to cut their tax rate. We're also looking to cut their canned tax rate, which is now 4.5, down to 4. Now, in an earlier hearing, we talked about, to the best we could, the evolution of these rates and why they are what they are. I don't think there's an easy and complete answer. The ancient history was there used to be a cannery tax and there used to be a cold storage tax. The cold storage tax kind of evolved into the shore-based processor tax. I don't know why there's a difference in rates between the shore-based and the canneries, and I think it's totally reasonable to say let's make them the same. I think the state benefits more from shore-based processing. We get property tax. We get more likely local employment. I think there's a reasonable reason to have a lower rate on the shore-based versus the floaters, my own personal opinion. But we weren't actively trying to do that. We're only trying to maintain that through an across-the-board 1% increase. So it's a little bit of a convoluted answer, but best I got to a reaction to 4444.
Follow-up, Representative Herron.
If I could ask Reed to hand the director this sheet of paper. In the sixth paragraph, the second to last paragraph, this group talks about loopholes. Could, from the department's view, what are they talking about? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, and the reason I brought up Mr. Sutton before is I don't consider myself a great expert on the nuance of fisheries taxation. The tax division collects 25 different taxes, and I can't know them all. But from what I understand and from what I know, there's some money being left on the table, so to speak, from some
sort of undervalued some of the smaller fishes, some of the, you know, you hear arrowtooth flounder, and like you hear these 2-cent valuations that are just sort of come through because of some formula, but that might not be the actual value. We need to do a better job of establishing a real value, because for the landing tax, as I understand it, we have a statutory value. It's not as reported. It's like we establish a value for a species based on a certain data set, and we might be doing an inadequate job of coming up with the proper value, and that's a couple of million dollars. I've heard anecdotally that sometimes processors might report a different number for tax purposes than they might report to ASME for marketing purposes. We need to do a more complete job of cross-referencing that and make sure that we're getting the real, a real and complete data set. But I don't know how we add up to $4 million through those things, but that's I could easily imagine it turning into those kind of numbers. I would like to hear from Pacific Seafood Processors as to where they'd like to get to $4 million.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins.
To what you just mentioned, Ken, so are you referring to the landing tax where there's these different prices assigned to different species and maybe some incongruency among those numbers?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, yes, that's my understanding.
Follow up.
So could you
expound on that a little bit? So you're saying you've got some of these low-value species, arrowtooth flounder, for instance, and I guess first question is, are there others, and if so, what are those as best you know off the top of your head? And then what kind of discrepancy are you seeing or have you seen between the reported value and therefore the value at which these species are taxed and whatever their actual value, however that might be defined, is? I mean, what kind of differential are we talking about, and what kind of foregone revenue does that amount to?
Madam Chairman, I really do need to phone a friend for this level of detail. I could try to answer, but it wouldn't have that much value to the committee. An important part of my job is to know what I don't know.
Madam Chair, Kevin Brooks, Fish and Game. Representative Christ Tompkins, we're currently working on this cost report that we provide to the Department of Revenue. And I was just checking through my file, and I don't have the information here with me, but my best understanding is that through valuation means that we have at our disposal, and what we're going to provide to revenue for taxation, it could generate up to $2 million more in revenue on some of these. There's a handful of species. Arrowtooth flounder's been mentioned. I don't have the list in front of me, but it's a short list of species that have been undervalued. We've identified it, and it'll be reflected in what we give to the Department of Revenue for use in taxation.
Thank you.
One follow-up.
So these
species that are being undervalued, where are they being caught approximately, and what fleet is catching them?
Through the chair, Representative Chris Tompkins, I'd have to get back to you. My understanding is it's federal waters. It's big boats offshore, not the smaller salmon fisheries. You know, we're talking about species that are caught while pursuing a pollock and other fisheries, and so they're caught and they're sold, and they've just been undervalued up until now.
Yeah. Just maybe a request for next hearing on this. $2 million is serious money when we're trying to raise that from, you know, a lot of small operations across Alaska. I'd be really interested to see where that undervaluation is coming from and how that might figure into the bigger picture.
And if I may, through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, this is an issue of the landing tax. So this is an offshore issue where there's a regulatory valuation coming from Fish and Game. With the business tax, the valuation, as I understand it, is based on the actual price paid to the fishermen. Like, so we're using an actual rather than an iterated value, and it makes a difference in the tax calculation. There's also larger issues of bycatch. To my understanding, there isn't really a tax on bycatch at all. So that's potentially foregone revenue if there's economic value to what's being accidentally caught.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Does any other member of the committee have any comments?
I was wondering
if
PSPA might be able to come up, similar to Representative Heron's question, and speak to the is it the $4 million that they the up to $4 million in loopholes that they referenced in their letter.
Mr. O'Shea, would you be able to answer some questions for this committee, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Vince O'Shea, Vice President, Pacific Seafood Processors Association.
Representative Heron.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. Vince, in the sixth paragraph, you had some ideas. Could you explain the loopholes and the $4 million figure?
Madam Chair, Representative Heron, yes, what happens right now is the Department of Fish and Game calculates a statewide average fish price, and that's based on reports from the processors. For some species, when those fish are delivered to our plants, they're not in a form that we can, frankly, turn into edible product just because of the time they've been out of the water. So we end up running them into the meal plant, and what shows up on the fish ticket is in the case of yellowfin sole, 2 cents a pound. But there is an offshore catcher processor fishery that catches and targets yellowfin sole, and that value, when they're processing them right when they come out of the water at sea, is anywhere between 16 and 18 cents a pound. So the difference is potentially 14 cents a pound, and in the case of yellowfin sole, if you give me just a second. In yellowfin sole, the poundage is 298 million pounds. So the difference of 16 or 12 cents a pound. There's another species that the offshore component targets out in the Western Aleutians, Atka mackerel, and the statewide fish price is 10 cents a pound on Atka mackerel, but there's estimates that the at-sea processor value is closer to 32 cents a pound, and the total tonnage there is 69 million pounds. It's my understanding that, as Deputy Commissioner Brooks had mentioned, the Department of Fish and Game has an analyst that's working on this issue. And if there's anywhere between six and eight of these, what I think we're calling generically problem species, and the estimated value in there was anywhere between potentially, I think it was $1.8 million to $2.4 million. So in the letter that, or the paper that we submitted to the committee, Madam Chair, we used a $2 million figure for that component. And I'll stop there.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Chris Tompkins.
So to summarize, Vince, you're saying for Atka mackerel, for instance, there's 69 million pounds of Atka mackerel caught. A lot of that or all of that pays fisheries landing tax. It's being valued by the Department of Revenue or by whoever's catching it at 10 cents a pound, whereas you're saying the market value is more like 32 cents a pound. And so there's foregone tax revenue on that 22 cent per pound difference.
Right, Madam Chair, correct. But I just want to make it clear. There's not an issue here of misreporting or underreporting. The value isn't derived by the at-sea processor putting a value on it and under-reporting it. The system is set up that the Department of Revenue operates off the statewide average price list, and that's derived from surveying the fish tickets from the processors. And quite frankly, we don't handle that much Atka mackerel, and it doesn't show up as a very valuable species. And again, I've already covered yellowfin sole, that we're not processing and selling yellowfin sole for food value, because by the time we get it, it can't be put into a saleable product. So people aren't doing anything per se wrong. Frankly, it's a technical gap in the system, and before raising taxes, we're simply saying on everybody, let's get a level playing field and have everybody paying at the same rate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So that's upwards of $2.4 million, and the letter that Representative Herron mentioned said upwards of $4 million in loopholes. Where does the other $1.6 million or change come from?
Right. I think the other issue is the issue of how end-of-season settlements are being treated by different companies. For example, the salmon fisheries, there at some point during the season, there's, you know, a base price is established so that harvesters have an idea of, for the person they're the company they're fishing for, what they're going to get, and they can start making business and fishing decisions. But of course, the final value of that pack is going to be based on what the processors are able to sell the fish for, and that may be many months later. So because we only get one shot at the fish, right? They're going up the river, and we need to buy them, and it's basically, frankly, a trust thing. We'll give you a minimum of this, and we may give you more if we can sell it for more. And that's the way this business has operated for many, many years. Well, at the end of the season, when some companies call them different terms, and one term is a retro or a price adjustment, when some companies pay that, it gets reported as an adjustment to what they paid out to the fishermen, and that goes into the calculation of what they're going to pay in terms of the fishery business tax. But not all companies operate that way, and we're simply asking the Department of Revenue to look at how all companies are handling their end-of-season price adjustments and make sure they're being treated the same way. And we believe the difference between how they're being treated could possibly account for another $2 million.
There's already, in addressing that specifically, Mr. O'Shea, there is already law on the books, and the Department of Revenue just needs to enforce it. There is something that covers bonuses, retro, profit sharing, however you want to call it, that covers those payments exactly, and it just needs to be enforced. But it is in existence. Are there other questions from this committee? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vince, there was some testimony earlier today about there's the argument that land-based versus vessel-based processing, land-based provides property taxes, provides local employment, those kinds of things. Thereby, there might be some justification for the differential between the two. Do you have anything to say about why it should maybe be level?
Madam Chair, Representative Ortiz, thank you for that question. I'm going to try to be careful here and give you all a concise answer. I think that at one point in the history of the evolution of the taxing scheme, there probably was a bias towards the fixed plants, some have observed today, the idea that they're paying property tax within the communities and more likely to have people from the community working in those plants as opposed to the floaters. The reason in our proposal of suggesting that maybe it's time to move that price back down to make them equal is sort of two things that are going on. One of them is that right now what we're getting from floaters is that in places, remote locations, where it doesn't make sense to build a plant and keep that investment in one place for 12 months a year, that by companies having the flexibility to bring floaters in, we can provide markets to fishermen for particular seasons and then take that investment and move it someplace else to provide markets in another place. So, for example, Bristol Bay, we're saying we kind of say it's a 30-day season, but if you look at where the big runs are, it's 10 or 15 days, and then it's done. And we have, our association members have huge investments in Bristol Bay, but you know what? It's for a piece of equipment that's going to sit idle for 11 months, 11 and a half months a year. So if you have a floater, what's going on right now, Madam Chair, for example, in Chignik, down in the Alaskan Peninsula, a small little community, one of my members, Triton, had a plant there, and the plant burned down. Well, the fishermen there are delivering codfish now because Triton brought in a floater to provide a market for those fishermen. And the floaters that are in Bristol Bay, when they're done, they'll move down and out, and they'll move into Prince William Sound and provide a market, and they'll move around. And the other part of that is it sounds nice to say, let's give a break to the shoreside plants so we can encourage development in the communities, but selling into global markets, it's going to be tough to build a brand-new plant in the middle of nowhere and have it pencil out. So I think, you know, times have changed, and I think it's actually providing more opportunity for Alaskan fishermen to have that capacity, be able to move around the state where we need it. And I think the second thing, Madam Chair, is one of the analysis that I looked at is says if you drop that down to 1%, you know, drop them 1%, you're talking $500,000 of foregone revenue. So in the whole scheme of things, it's not a big thing. I agree, the fixed thing, paying taxes in the community, I agree that makes sense, but we have companies, I have companies that have fixed plants, and then we also operate floaters.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Any further questions from this committee? Thank you, Mr. O'Shea, we appreciate it.
Thanks. Sorry to drop my glasses and stuff, I wasn't expecting to testify.
No problem.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Madam Chair, I was wondering, based on your comments and also Vince's, if maybe the Department of Revenue could speak to retro and some of Vince's comments about making sure that all companies are playing by the same rules in terms of how they pay fisheries business tax.
Certainly. It looks like there's a discussion as to who's going to get in the hot seat.
I think there's a coin toss going on.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
The coin landed on the edge.
Welcome again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start. The Chair, Ken Alper, Tax Division Director. I was talking to Deputy Commissioner Burnett while we were hearing earlier testimony. We are obligated, as you said, to enforce that. It's really a question of auditing, the end of season adjustment type stuff. We have added a new auditor to staff. We have more resources, having moved some other things around. We do want to. This is one of those things that we really don't want to leave any money laying on the table. I think I've said it in other committees and other circumstances. We don't want to raise our existing taxes until we know that we're getting as much as we're supposed to from the taxes we already have, no question. If there really is $4 million to be have, I would rather Alaska have that $4 million than not have it. As for the technical mechanism to do these end-of-season adjustments, I believe it's through the audit process. I'm going to turn over to Tom here, who might be able to give a little more insight into what it actually is going to take to make sure that people are doing that properly and that we capture some of that revenue.
For the record, my name, again, is Tom Sutton, and I work for the tax section, Fish Group. In regards to enforcement, I, too, concur with what Ken is saying. You know, we certainly want to bring in every tax dollar that's due to the state, and that's our objective, of course, and that's our mission. But in regards to it being seemed that others are paying bonuses, some organizations are paying bonuses, and then other organizations or entities are not paying bonuses, it may very well be because of the type of organization we're looking at. There are fish groups that are co-ops. There are some where a fisherman may invest in a company. And as an investor, they maybe do not receive a bonus, but other means of compensation. So we're talking about different organizations and different platforms of how fishermen are being paid. So, but in so far as to make sure that everybody is on a clean playing field, it's going to require our section to take a look at every organization and to see how they are made up organized-wise. Are they what kind of a corporate, if they're a corporation, co-op, or even investment opportunities such as an LLC for fishermen? And due to the lack of resources in the past in conducting these kind of audits, it was more of a paper chase for the fish section. And now that we have revenue online, we're actually have devoted, instead of, for example, instead of having a fish technician, we've converted that position to an auditor. So we've got myself and two others that are auditors now, and we are certainly going to advance our expertise in these areas, in that area and other areas. In regards to, now there was another question that you had through the chair to Mr. Chris Tompkins, and I would could you repeat that second portion of the question?
I'm actually not. It's escaped me at this point what it was in the past, but that was a helpful overview. Of
okay. But in Mr. Sutton, in response to a couple of your comments, whether it be an LLC or whatever the entity is, if they're being paid for the fish in a retroactive manner, call it what you want. They need to pay the appropriate dollars on those fish. So, you know, I'm not quite sure where the two fall into each other, into the same category when you're talking about depending on what kind of entity it is. Fish or fish or fish. And if, like I said, call it what you want, a bonus, a retro, a later payment, it's still on the same fish. Right. Correct?
Well, may I clarify something
certainly,
to the chair?
Please do.
Let me give you an example. If a fisherman has invested in an LLC that's processing the fish and taking care of it and selling it, he has an investment there. He gets a return on that investment. Now we have another situation where we may have a fisherman who sells to a processor, separate entities, and at and as Mr. O'Shea was commenting about, at the end of the year, that processing entity may find that they underpaid the fisherman, and to be fair to that fisherman and other fishermen, because they pay different rates as the season goes through, because the competitive nature of fish, right? And to make things fair, they provide a bonus, if you will, to those fishermen. And they, when they pay that bonus, they make an amendment to their tax return, initial tax return, and so they're taxed on those additional bonuses. As opposed to an LLC who has investors and remunerate those investors through the means that they have, which is a sharing of revenue.
But, and I'm not trying to be argumentative here, but I think what we're talking about is, as Mr. O'Shea indicated, when they first deliver their fish, you get the minimum amount for your fish. Correct? I believe that's what he said. And when they pay a retro, or they say, well, we were able to sell your fish for more than that, here's these dollars. That's not a return on your investment. That's a return on those fish that you sold them, that they sold. And so those are the fish that I'm talking about. I'm not talking about an investor's return on their investment in way of an LLC or a partnership or whatever it is. I'm talking about the actual fish that were delivered and the manner in which the payment is made. And what, call it whatever you want, when you're getting a retro or a bonus or whatever it is on those fish need to be accounted for tax dollar wise.
Madam Chair, if I may, can I help you here? I think you're absolutely right. And I think the auditing challenge for us to try to sort of put this in non-accounting terms, you give a bonus to the guy who's just a fisherman from the processor, that sort of that establishes the track record of the price. Another guy gets a bonus who happens to also own the plant because he's a shareholder in a co-op or something like that. The argument could be made, well, that's just profit sharing. That's not really a bonus. And then our challenge is to compare that to what some guy who wasn't an owner got. And so that the portion that equalizes it, well, that's the retro. And the portion above that, that might be the profit share. And it's an accounting exercise. It's a paper-chasing exercise, but that's our job. That's what we're supposed to do.
You took the words right out of my mouth. That's your job. Representative Herron.
Yes. Different subject. Returning to the processors, Ocean Beauty Icicle. Of course, you defended your boss's proposal, and I expect you to do that. And then you made some comments, and then we asked Vince to come up, and he shared his view. So in fairness, Madam Chair, I would like the director to sort of rebut what the proposal says as articulated by Vince.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, and I like getting put on the spot, and I thank you for that. It's sharpening. I did have the opportunity to work for the Department of Fish and Game about a dozen years ago, and in that capacity had the ability to visit some of the remote fisheries. So I've seen some of these things with my own eyes. I was in that Trident plant in Chignik in 2004, I think, before it burned down. Mr. O'Shea makes some excellent points. He's right. Where we have these highly time-constrained fisheries, where all the work gets done in a few weeks, there is value to have floaters come in that could work the line for among the different fisheries over the as the season moves in different areas of the state. So he's saying maybe we should tax those guys a little bit less to encourage that to happen because it might lead to more opportunity. I don't know to the extent that's really going to happen, but it is rational to say there's a benefit of having these mobile fish processing plants to come around. I don't know if that value is enough to say let's lower their tax rate and try to equalize it across the state, but I hadn't heard that argument before, and it's a reasonable argument.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
just a short follow-up. So Director Alper, is that what I've gathered from that response is in working with the Madam Chair that the 4x4 proposal is not out of the question for your boss.
The Chair, Representative Herron, the 4x4 proposal is about a $15 million revenue estimate, according to Mr. O'Shea, and his math makes about right sense to us. The proposal before you was to raise about $18 million. There's no magic in the numbers, certainly, although the governor wanted somewhere in that $15 to $20 million range, in part to cover the fact that the general fund shortfall within the commercial fisheries budget. So if you're in that range, I don't think anyone's going to balk and scream. If I may just sort of pull something out of thin air and suggest, if you look at how, say, oil and gas property taxes work, we have the ability to tax things so long as they're doing business in the state at the moment, at the location where they are in January. You know, maybe we need to establish some means of collecting a property tax on floating processors to create some level of equity in that industry so that we don't actively disadvantage those communities who benefit from having shore-based processors.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from this committee?
I have a request of the Department of Revenue, if I may, and maybe Department of Fish and Game. So this is to sort of add on to what I previously expressed interest, which is a little bit more backup on what the Department of Fish and Game, as we understand, is actively working on in terms of these species valuations, Atka mackerel, yellowfin sole that Vince testified, and have maybe a pretty wide spread between what they're being taxed at and what their market value might be. Second piece of information I'd be really interested to see, and going a bit afield from what we're just talking about right now, but previous testimony relates to, is sort of a comparative analysis of how much revenue goes to the state of Alaska for public resource fish across different sectors, and creating an apples-to-apples comparison between, say, you know, a coho salmon or halibut or whatever, but the amount of value of fish that's been extracted by different sectors in Alaska and how much revenue per unit value or per unit weight or whatever each sector is paying, and whether those numbers are equitable and whether every sector is contributing equitably. And, you know, one sector may be paying a lot more. They might be about ballpark right now, but I'd be really interested in seeing that analysis, especially when we're talking about, you know, raising revenue on this public resource and asking a lot of people to shoulder a burden.
Through the chair, Representative Price Tompkins, it's an excellent request. I'm glad to see Tom writing so that we have record of it. It's a relatively robust analysis. I don't know. It's something we can do in days rather than in weeks or months. This might be an interim project for us, but we should be able to parse out and report on the revenue that we receive from fishery to fishery. What I can't promise is the other side of the equation, and you might need to bring Mr. Brooks or someone else from Fish and Game here. How they spend their money to manage different fisheries might not be quite so easy to parse out. So we might not be able to identify the extent to which the money is going where you think it might be going. The commercial fishery is a big commingled operation.
Revenue side is fine.
Christ, I'm good too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as far as revenue raised, and no matter on expenditures, but just on the revenue side.
Certainly, we'll start lining it out and try to figure out how much of a data lift it is through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, and we will get it to you as soon as we can. I'm not going to promise it until I talk to some other folks.
If you could provide it to the chair, we could provide it to all committee members.
Without question, Madam.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, is there any other business to come before this committee? Seeing none. Oh, you want to do your...
Sure. If I may, Madam Chair, offer amendment number one.
Okay.
Thank you. And I just like to get this on the record sort of for the purposes of discussion and withdraw, partly because even if this were to go forward, I think it could perhaps be more gracefully drafted, but this is speaking to a testimony received earlier about developing fisheries. Doesn't raise a whole lot of money, or the tax break or tax differential that exists doesn't amount to a whole hill of beans, as some have sort of stated. And so the thought is just sort of getting rid of it, getting rid of the paperwork and administrative hassle when you've got different tax rates for very select species from very select fisheries, and just sort of making it flat across the board, and that's what this amendment speaks to. I'd like to withdraw the amendment, but just sort of get that out there as something for all of us maybe to think about, and also members of the public to be aware of.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further comments? Okay, seeing none, we thank you all, gentlemen, for coming up to our hot seat, and seeing no business, further business before this committee. We will not be meeting on Thursday due to our budget meetings and House session. So this bill will be staying in committee, and I appreciate you all coming. And I will adjourn House Committee on Fisheries at 11:30.